Charles Swift on behalf of the appellate Armin Harsovic. May it please this honorable court. The appellate reserves 3 minutes of his time allotted for rebuttal. The appellate's plea was based, the factual basis for the appellate's plea in this case, is that on September of 2013, he agreed to provide and then provided money to a person he believed was fighting with the Free Syrian Army against President Assad and his governmental forces. Based on this factual support, the court accepted Mr. Harsovic's plea to conspiracy to materially support and materially supporting an act of terrorism in the form of murder and maiming abroad in violation of 18 U.S.C. 2339A. Before this court are two questions. The first is whether the appellate's plea of guilty to the charges waived his right to challenge the charges further. The second is whether the appellate's admitted conduct was within the subject matter jurisdiction of the court. The key to answering both questions is whether a U.S. person fighting in support of the Free Syrian Army against Assad could be prosecuted for murder and maiming abroad based on their belligerent activities. Or put another way, does the court have jurisdiction?
Counsel, something I was going to ask you, and you've reframed it, but you have three argument sections in your brief, only one of which is jurisdictional. And you just named two questions this morning, one of which is jurisdictional. Why doesn't the plea waive everything that is not a legitimate jurisdictional defect?
The second section deals with the law of war question, and it's also jurisdictional, Your Honor. But I focus my argument today on the jurisdictional question.
But how about parts two and three of your brief? If your jurisdictional argument is unsuccessful, aren't they waived by the plea?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and I believe they're intertwined because all of it goes toward jurisdiction in this case.
That's easy to say, but it's not at all intuitive.
Perhaps, Your Honor, if I could address that in looking at the conduct and whether it's within the jurisdiction of the court that's admitted and loop back a bit on it. Your Honor, the government argues that the answer to both of those questions, the waiver and the court's jurisdiction, is yes, because a person in fighting against Assad with the Free Syrian Army would not enjoy combatant immunity under the laws of war. Your Honors, respectfully, the government's wrong. And the reason is that the answer to all of these questions is not found in the laws of war. The answer is found in the separation of powers doctrine that governs foreign affairs when the executive has acted. And we rely, Your Honors, in this case, on the case of United States or Palmer versus United States, which is a seminal case at the beginning of the doctrine of separation of powers. In that case, Chief Justice Marshall held that someone who was fighting in a civil war on behalf of the rebels was beyond the jurisdiction of a court because to do otherwise would be to take sides in a civil war that the president had already declared and found, and that the court couldn't aid one side or the other.
Counsel, what's the effect of the Geneva Conventions?
The Geneva Conventions have no effect here, Your Honor, in this part, because the Geneva Conventions deal only with, in Common Article 3, the sovereign state in which the conduct is being conducted. Common Article 3 deals with them. If the conduct was in the United States, Common Article 3 would apply. But here, what happens under it, and it needs to be understood, Your Honors, that at the time of Palmer, rebels did not enjoy immunity under the laws of war. They didn't have any immunity. And in fact, rebels were considered traitors, fighters, or seditions. Sometimes there would be local agreements on that.
Counsel, this is Judge Loken. You know, your argument is that just because you say the executive branch has exercised its power in this way, nobody in the United States today can challenge your client for his otherwise criminal conduct, right? You know, Hamaluddin, or how you pronounce it in the Fourth Circuit, They considered jurisdiction, but it was jurisdiction of the military courts versus the civil courts. You're saying nobody has jurisdiction, right?
I am saying that nobody has jurisdiction over the
including the the executive has no prosecutorial authority and no has no power to convict. Congress hasn't conferred that power, right?
That's correct, Your Honors.
All right, so now we have, you're saying the judiciary can't touch this because it's executive matter, and the executive can't touch it because Congress hasn't given the executive unilateral authority to convict. So you're saying your client, by your assertion of what the executive branch has done, gets out of jail free, so to speak, right?
Well, for supporting the Free Syrian
right or
Army.
Right or wrong, is that your, have I properly stated your position?
There's a little more subtlety to it than that, Your Honor.
I didn't on this was, look, you can make your argument after you answer my question.
Yes. For murder and maiming, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
For murder and maiming, yes. And the reason for that is that the executive is charging this count, puts the court aiding Assad in a foreign conflict, because that's what's really happening. The victim, Your Honor, is Assad and the Assad forces. And where the executive has decided that that's a civil war, and those facts were recognized and adopted by the court, that in that case, then there's no prosecution. Now, to Your Honor's point, there may be multiple other ways to prosecute and multiple other forces.
Name one.
Neutrality Act violation. The Neutrality Act was passed after
Wait. No. We're talking about litigating the 2339A statute in the face of the what I call the defense you have asserted.
In litigating the 2339A, there would be no way with the Free Syrian Army. Now, the government could maintain that he was with other forces, that those forces did not have the same recognition.
Counsel, that's the merits. We're talking jurisdiction.
And
you're saying in some other imaginary a prosecution under some other statute, I guess, or maybe you're saying this has to be done in Europe or Asia, but you're saying that no one in the United States has the power to determine whether your assertion of what of your interpretation of the executive branch's actions creates this defense.
Well, that's
and
what
that frankly, that is borders on preposterous to me.
Well, that's what the court said in Palmer, Your Honor. In Palmer.
In what?
In Palmer versus United States, that's exactly what the Supreme Court said.
Palmer didn't turn on jurisdiction. The court addressed the merits.
In the merits in it, what it found, Your Honor, was that Captain Palmer's belligerent acts were outside the jurisdiction of the court, that ordinary belligerent acts on behalf of a rebel, when the president had recognized a state of civil war, were beyond their jurisdiction. Now, returning to Judge Loken's question, on the part, is let's say that the Free Syrian Army commits war crimes, recognized war crimes, such as killing civilians. Yes, there's jurisdiction over that. That's an international crime. Let's say that they use nerve gas. Yes, there's a part on that. There would be jurisdiction for acts that are not within the laws of war. But when the executive has recognized a civil war, and this is a very narrow exception, it is narrow to every other conflict. We've had none. We've had very few come up. Where are the executive?
But counsel, you just asserted what the executive has done, and the government argues vehemently to the contrary, and now you're saying nobody gets to say I'm wrong because of my jurisdictional argument based on a case from the 1820s that didn't turn on jurisdiction, right? That's your position.
It is my position, and my position is supported by two facts. Is the case in Palmer, the only reason for reversing Palmer was not that the laws of war gave him protection. Nowhere does the court cite the laws of war for this. Nowhere does the court cite, in part, Palmer is recognized as a separation of powers doctrine. It is not recognized as a law of war case. It is continuously cited as a separation of powers doctrine on the part. And the idea on why they could not try the man, and the government's case actually really asserts, one of the cases cited by the government is later on that in 1820 or so, there was another piracy case that came before, but not in the Civil War. The court had jurisdiction over that. And the key fact here is that President Obama had recognized a state of civil war. And that was factually accepted. He had stated that publicly. And in the record on it, he had recognized a state of civil war. Things changed. This is actually a very brief period of time, but it is a critical period of time for this offense. Because in this offense, occurs in the conduct of a civil war. And in a civil war where we've recognized it, and again, this is a rare period of time, then there is no prosecution for either belligerents for ordinary acts in that war. Otherwise, how are we neutral? We're prosecuting people who are fighting on one side. Under the court's theory of the part is, if Mr. Harsifek had instead given money to Assad, and his forces, or given forces to people fighting in Assad's forces, everything would be fine. They're national combatants. And that doesn't make sense, because clearly in this side, on the part, was that we had recognized a state of civil war. We had recognized and favored the Free Syrian Army. Mr. Harsifek provided monies to them in that process, to people that he believed. This is not a case about ISIS. This is not a case about other belligerents. This is only about the Free Syrian Army and the president's declaration and the idea that these people would now be called into U.S. courts
for fighting ISIS. I thought the indictment named ISIS as the place where, as the group that Pizarro was representing or fighting for when he did the murder and mayhem.
In this, that's a critical point, Your Honor, in this. The indictment named ISIS as one of the groups in the area, but Mr. Harsifek did not plead guilty to that. His factual basis was supporting the Free Syrian Army, and the court accepted.
That doesn't matter. The indictment defines the jurisdictional issue, not the plea.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, when defendant puts forth a factual basis, that factual basis must be sufficient in its of itself. The court inquired as to whether the government was satisfied with that, and they said under the court's findings, they were, that a Free Syrian Army constituted an offense. So this isn't an ISIS case.
Counsel, where in your brief is it argued that there was no factual basis for the plea?
Well, the factual basis is the idea that the factual basis is insufficient for jurisdiction. It is insufficient to establish jurisdiction here. And that's one of the questions you ask when you look at the factual basis that comes into a plea. And where the factual basis is insufficient, then the court has no jurisdiction. Well, that's why we ask in federal court or a district court judge will ask for a factual basis to ensure that it satisfies all of the elements, including the jurisdictional ones. Here it is not.
Mr. Swift, you're well into your rebuttal time. You can continue to argue if you like, or you could reserve.
I'll reserve the remainder.
All right. Mr. Palmer?
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Joseph Palmer from the Justice Department. The defendant in this case pleaded guilty unconditionally, and that plea relinquished his lawful belligerency claim. A claim of lawful belligerency is a non-jurisdictional affirmative defense. And like other such defenses, it is waived unless the defendant specifically reserves his right to appeal it by entering a conditional plea. A lawful belligerency claim doesn't implicate the district court's subject matter jurisdiction. The district court had subject matter jurisdiction here under Section 3231.
Is there an appellate case that's expressly, explicitly held that?
The cases have explicitly held that lawful belligerency is an affirmative defense, and that precludes it from being a subject matter jurisdiction claim. Affirmative defenses only come into the case when the defendant raises them. Subject matter jurisdiction claims can be raised at any point in the proceedings, and even sua sponte by the court. This court's cases and the Supreme Court's cases make clear that subject matter jurisdiction in a federal criminal offense arises under Section 3231 when the indictment properly alleges federal offenses. And the indictment does that here. That is the beginning and the end of the subject matter jurisdiction inquiry. The defendant's lawful belligerency claim also doesn't fall within the exception for certain constitutional claims that might otherwise survive a conditional plea that the Supreme Court has recognized in Blackledge and Mena and Class. A lawful belligerency, any constitutional claim, even assuming that the defendant's claim is the proper kind of constitutional claim that would otherwise fall within Blackledge and Mena, those claims can only survive a conditional guilty plea if they are clear on the face of the record and if they don't contradict the allegations in the indictment. In this case, the indictment specifically alleges that the foreign fighter that the defendant supported, Pizarra, fought on behalf of terrorist organizations. The defendant has alleged that Pizarra fought for the Free Syrian Army, but the government has never conceded that fact, and it's specifically contradicted by the indictment's allegations. The Supreme Court's decision in Bros is clear that even constitutional claims that fall within the Blackledge-Mena exception must be clear on the face of the record in order to survive the plea, and that's not true here. The defendant's claim depends on his establishing, as a matter of fact, what groups Pizarra fought for, and the defendant's request for relief from this court that the district court on remand conduct fact-finding proceedings effectively concedes that his claim is not established on the record. Because his claim depends on claims that are contrary to the indictment, then the Supreme Court's decision in Bros is clear that that claim is waived by a conditional guilty plea. The defendant has argued that the government effectively stipulated to the facts that he raised in the plea hearing. The government did agree that the defendant's admissions at the plea were that he admitted to all the elements of the offense, and that was a sufficient factual basis. But that in no way concedes that the defendant did in fact, or that the Pizarra did in fact fight for the Free Syrian Army. A factual basis does not require the defendant to admit facts that go to an affirmative defense. It requires only that the defendant admit sufficient facts to establish the elements. And the defendant's admission that his material support was intended to support killing by Pizarra, that was a sufficient to establish the elements of the offense, and that is all that the government conceded at the plea hearing. We never conceded the facts that the defendant has asserted and that contradict the specific allegations in the indictment.
Counsel, it's Judge Loken. Let me ask you a question from what I see as our perspective. What you're now arguing, you're now talking really the merits of what you've already described as, the fact inquiry that's been requested on remand, and the briefs spend a lot of time on these rather confusing concepts and issues. In your view, if your affirmative defense argument is sound, do we need to reach any of the the Geneva Convention impact and whether Article 4, 3, or 2, what role they played here?
No, Your Honor. The court could resolve the case without reaching any of those issues simply by holding that the defendant's unconditional guilty plea relinquished his lawful belligerency claim because it contradicted the facts that are alleged in the indictment.
Thank you.
So then, are you saying that we need not grapple with the issue of executive superiority? or executive power? I mean, if in fact the executive had taken a position supporting the defendant's action here, you would not have been able to file that indictment.
Yes, I agree that the court would have to reach the defendant's argument that that this case implicated subject matter jurisdiction. Our position is that even if it were true that the Palmer case established a separation of powers rule, that would go to the merits. Even if it prevented the prosecution, that would be a defense that the defendant would raise. It would not go to the subject matter jurisdiction of the court. The court's subject matter jurisdiction in federal criminal cases arises under Section 3231, which provides jurisdiction over all offenses against the United States. The indictment here alleges an offense against the United States, and it alleges conduct on behalf of terrorist organizations that sufficiently establishes the district court's subject matter jurisdiction to then adjudicate the constitutional claims or the lawful belligerency claims that the defendant has raised. The district court had jurisdiction to adjudicate them.
Mr. Palmer, this is Judge Smith. Would you address the class case and its interaction with subject matter jurisdiction for constitutional claims?
Yes, Your Honor. The Supreme Court in class recognized an exception for non-jurisdictional but constitutional claims that might survive an unconditional plea. The claim in class, the Second Amendment challenge, was not a jurisdictional challenge, and the defendant in that case acknowledged that it wasn't, and that it could be waived by a plea agreement that specifically waived it. And so the category of cases that the Supreme Court recognized in Blackledge and Mena in class, such as constitutional challenges to the statute of conviction or double jeopardy claims, are not subject matter jurisdiction claims. They are simply claims that aren't automatically waived by a guilty plea. But a condition on the application of that exception is that the claims be established on the face of the record and that they not contradict the allegations in the indictment. The Supreme Court's decision in Brose makes clear that even Blackledge Mena constitutional claims are relinquished by an unconditional plea if they contradict the indictment or if they require fact-finding that's not before the record, that's not in the record that's before the court. Your Honor, just turning very briefly to the merits. In the alternative, this court could resolve this case simply by finding that the government's statement that it considered the Syrian Opposition Council to be the legitimate representative of the Syrian people did not constitute a recognition of the lawful belligerency of the Free Syrian Army. The government statement did not use the terms lawful belligerency. If the government had intended to immunize U.S. citizens who traveled overseas to fight in a foreign war, or people in the United States who use the U.S. territory as a base of operations to support that fighting, it would have done so explicitly. Representatives of the United States clarified that the government statement was intended to be a political step, a signal of political support for the Syrian Opposition Council, and not a legal recognition that would change the legal status of the Syrian Opposition Council. This court should defer to that explanation and to the position of the United States that representatives of the executive branch have articulated in district court and in this court and have clearly represented that the position of the United States is that the United States has never recognized the Free Syrian Army as lawful belligerents.
Well, who spoke for the United States? Was it President Obama or a bunch of lackeys at the State Department?
The president speaks for the United States, as do the State Department representatives, Your Honor, but the president's statement does not use the terms lawful belligerency. The president stated that the government considered the Syrian Opposition Council to be the legitimate representative of the Syrian people, and the State Department representatives clarified that statement was intended to be a political step and not to confer legal status on the police union requirement. Your Honor, if there are no further questions, I'll yield my time.
All right. Mr. Swift?
Briefly, Your Honors, because I have, the government attempts to have its cake and eat it too. The government on the ISIS question, the government maintained at trial that it didn't matter whether he was fighting for ISIS or not. And I would cite to our brief where we point out that as long as putting yourself in front
of
the...
At trial? Did you just say at trial?
Or at the hearing, at the plea hearing, Your Honor, the government maintained that it didn't matter whether he was fighting for ISIS. The government agreed that as long as this court believes that putting yourself in front of an oncoming soldier, that means killing, based on the court's earlier rulings, that the Free Syrian Army had no status, it doesn't matter. Respectfully put, that can't be contradictory to the plea. If being in the Free Syrian Army is sufficient to satisfy the plea, then that is alive. Secondly, the government misstates once the president has made clear that he recognizes a state of civil war, as Your Honor has pointed out, that's what the court takes. The president speaks. It is the executive's power. And what we find ourselves in is a case all too absolutely factually analogous to Palmer. We are back to Palmer. It's a very narrow exception. It hasn't come before the courts before, and it may, recently didn't in any of the post 9/11 because we were participating in those combatancies. And it wouldn't have applied for very long because we were later participating in the combatancy. It's a brief window in time, but it is a window in time which where fighting for the Free Syrian Army was not a criminal act within the jurisdiction of murder and maiming abroad. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Swift. Thank you also, Mr. Palmer. The court appreciates both counsel's argument presentation to the court. It's been helpful in resolving the difficult issues in this case. We'll take it under advisement.